Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Nicholas Haslach makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of Legal Limits, which is essays, part memoir. Now, Nicholas Haslach is well known to all of you, but I will introduce him briefly. He's a QC. He studied law at the University of Western Australia, then at Wadham College in Oxford, before returning to Australia to become a practicing lawyer in Perth. Nicholas Haslach served as a part-time president of the Equal Opportunity Tribunal in Western Australia for 10 years before being appointed to the Supreme Court of Western Australia in May 2000. Now, he's now retired from the bench and he's busy doing what he's always done, which is writing books. He's the author of 12 works of fiction, including The Bellarmine Jug, which was the winner of the Age Book of the Year award, and he's had many other appointments. But as I said tonight, Nicholas Haslach is here on the occasion of the publication of Legal Limits, and he's going to address the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic, Reopening the Whitlam File. Nicholas Haslach, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me add to what Gerard has just said, and thank you for coming out midweek on a busy night. I noticed on the way into these premises that it is indeed my first time here, and I noticed that the premises were opened back in 1947 by no less a person than the little digger Billy Hughes. And I was reminded that when I was a young boy, and soon after my father entered Parliament, Billy Hughes at that time, shortly after the 1949 election, was still in Parliament. And although my father never introduced me to him, he did point him out, and that made quite a profound impression on the mind of a nine-year-old boy as I was at the time, a small, gnarled figure with hearing aid and a very distinctive figure. I knew nothing about his background, particularly at that time. But I must say, as the years have gone by and my own age has advanced, I've come to treasure that glimpse because, in a way, it's a slightly personalised connection with the various very earliest days of the Australian Constitution and the Australian Federation, of the politicians from that early era. So I suppose that's just a brief introduction to what I'm about to come to, which, as Gerard has indicated, is the topic reopening the Whitlam file. And perhaps I could begin by mentioning this, that at the Windsor Hotel in Melbourne, shortly before the Governor-General determined his appointment as Prime Minister, Mr. Whitlam spoke to a gathering of writers. He said, and I quote, "The climate for Australian writing is brighter," unquote. He described the support given to writers by his government in this way, quote, "Since 1973, the Literature Board has awarded 269 fellowships, compared with 207 awarded by the Commonwealth Literary Fund in 34 years from 1939 to 1972, unquote. Mr. Whitlam closed by saying that the challenge for the writer is to adapt his ancient and difficult craft to a generation that is largely insensitive to its virtues and to a popular audience increasingly distracted by the pace, immediacy, and materialism of contemporary life. This is an immensely difficult but profoundly important task," he said. Now, there's a good deal of truth in these latter observations, but as to the challenge for Whitlam himself,
the pace of life was about to become a stampede. Within a few weeks after heated debate about the Kemlani loan scandal and the state of the economy, the Liberal Party used its numbers in the Senate to defer supply. A few weeks after that, as we know, on 11 November 1975, the Governor-General Sir John Kerr sacked Whitlam for refusing to resign or advise an election after failing to obtain supply. On the advice of the new Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, both Houses of Parliament were then dissolved, and in the following election, Whitlam's Labour Party was soundly defeated. Climate for writing had changed. The Whitlam sacking resulted in a tidal wave of new writing, fortunately not accompanied by a two tsunami of literary grunts, but bringing with it torrents of print ranging from angry placards to the memoirs of the main players, from skilled journalism to theories implicating the CIA, from well-researched tomes to the pronouncements of academic gadflies and highly priced silks. It is a moot question as to how many of these effusions met the challenge for the writer outlined by Mr. Whitlam at the Windsor Hotel before his downfall. Indeed, as the deposed leader said at the launch of his own book, The Whitlam Government, with characteristic wit, quote, "For a number of years up to 1983, the Whitlam book industry was our largest growth industry after tax avoidance." Well, the industry has continued to thrive. The Whitlam Legacy, edited by the well-known journalist Troy Bramston, is a recent addition to the stockpile. It brings together contributions by a number of high-profile and distinguished individuals and includes a chapter co-authored by Paul Kelly and the editor himself, The Untold Story of the Dismissal, in which recent disclosures concerning the Governor-General's consultations with members of the High Court are carefully reviewed and assessed. The purpose of the book, according to the editor's introduction, and I quote, "is not to eulogise or demonise, celebrate or denigrate the Whitlam government, but rather to acknowledge its successes and achievements alongside its flaws, mistakes and misjudgments," unquote. Nonetheless, the editor feels obliged to confess that in compiling the book, he was, quote, "energized not by the lingering unjustness of the dismissal, but rather the lasting legacy of the Whitlam years. It is a legacy that extends to the rebirth of Labour in the 1960s to almost every area of policy and to the way politics is practiced in the modern era." He ends by saying, I quote, "the legacy endures because in the final analysis, Edward Gough Whitlam understood what politics is fundamentally about, leadership," unquote. Now, there is obviously room for disagreement with the views expressed by Troy Bramston and by many of his contributors, and much room for debate about the significance of the main events. On both sides of politics, the Whitlam era and the dismissal continue to arouse strong emotions. In those who were there at the time, and in certain members of the next generation, as in the case of Troy Bramston himself, who have studied circumstances and formed a view. But inevitably, some of the passion has subsided. Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser have been photographed together on various public occasions. Gough Whitlam's denunciation of Sir John Kerr in his book The Truth of the Matter was followed by a later work, Abiding Interest, which opens with this assertion, where Mr. Whitlam says, I quote, "my chief interest in the events of October-November 1975 now lies in their relevance to Australia's advance towards the Republic," unquote. Now, my purpose in my address to you tonight is not to add to the debate about flaws or achievements, or even to embark upon yet another detailed analysis of the events preceding the dismissal, although admittedly as a lawyer and as the son of a former Governor General who was in office when Whitlam came to power in 1972, Sir Paul Hasluck, I've tried to keep abreast of writings about the Whitlam government and its downfall, and I admit to having added to the stockpile myself. Some evidence of that over there. What is presently of interest to me, bearing in mind Whitlam's description of the challenge for the writer, as he put it before he was sacked, is the paucity of artistic works about this unique era in Australian history. Where are the writers engaged in what Gough Whitlam called the profoundly important task of adapting their craft to a popular audience that is increasingly subject to many distractions? A TV series called The Dismissal went to air and reached a large audience in the early 1980s. But you'll probably recall that this was in the nature of a dramatised documentary. The actors echoed what was said and done in actuality. It lacked the intensity of vision to be found in so many enduring works of literature, that is, the singular view in which an underlying truth is not only revealed, but given a special force by the manner of its expression. 40 years on, is there room within the Whitlam legacy for writing of a different kind? Tale that looks beyond the details for particular insights or a memorable theme? This question was prompted to me by the last three lines in Troy Bramston's anthology, a passage in which one of Whitlam's earliest political supporters, Les Johnson, is quoted. Johnson played a key role in Whitlam's pre-selection for the seat of Werriwa in 1952. In securing the deputy leadership of the party for Whitlam 8 years later, and as a member of Whitlam's ministry. Johnson is quoted to this effect. There were great achievements, they are mind-boggling achievements, a record not matched by any government since. But great attributes can soon become great shortcomings. Our drive to do things and our passion in those early days became a curse. Curiously, the words that close this carefully compiled anthology, these ruminations by a former minister, eager to pay tribute to a long-standing political friend, but not blind to the Whitlam government's faults, touch the tragic chord so often found in great works of literature. They bear an eerie resemblance to Hamlet's ruminations on the battlements of Elsinore, which gain force by the manner of their expression and can, for present purposes, be paraphrased as follows. So oft it chances that a man bearing the stamp of one defect, though his virtues be performed at height and pure as grace, will in the general censure take corruption from that one particular fault. Thus, in laying aside the Bramston book with these words in mind, it is tempting to look for some of the insights or deeper truths that storytellers might find within the Whitlam saga. At a time 40 years after the event, and for many people, the details are becoming increasingly difficult to recall. In addition to the flawed hero motif singled out by Whitlam's staunch supporter Les Johnson, various other themes potentially of interest to a popular audience invite consideration, although, as Whitlam's speechwriter Graham Freudenberg noted, if only by reason of its extraordinary end, there will always be great difficulty in making a final judgment on the Whitlam government. Some novelists or playwrights might be inclined to treat the reforming vision which made a martyr of its principal proponent as the true centre of the story. For others, it might be the ambiguity as to where exactly real power lies within this country's democratic processes, as between the Parliament, the Executive, the reserve powers of the Crown, and the ever-present media cycle and opinion polls. Or does the story of the Whitlam era and its ending continue to unsettle and disturb because it bears upon the frailty of the democratic system and the related risk of chaos if power be exercised capriciously? What degree of dissent is justifiable if a government is thought to have been displaced by questionable means? Or does it all come down to Parliament and the corridors of power viewed as an arena where a wide range of personal and political ambitions are played out? Perhaps, as Scott Whitlam himself has intimated, the era and the nature of its ending simply points the way to the creation of a republic. The more one thinks about the Whitlam era at this distance of time and in the light of later events, the more the larger questions seem to multiply. What can we learn from an era in which the leader of an avowedly innovative government is viewed as a kind of messiah and therefore takes it upon himself to be constantly active in pressing for change and keeping the media fascinated? Will the frenetic pace inherent in such a role lead eventually to increasing dysfunction as the leader and those around him, seduced by their own rhetoric, substitute feints and gestures for real action? Can a work of fiction, by taking liberties not available to the conscientious journalist, by exploring ambiguities or magnifying certain features of the scene, draw attention to ill-advised adventures or assist the average punter to identify an ideologue? Questions of this kind can't be taken lightly or dismissed as a mere literary conceit. For we have witnessed the downward spiral in Australian politics, and the activism of a leader in the Whitlam era, where new policies show a clear sense of purpose, to the vacuous repartee of the Rudd regime, so ably satirised by the TV series The Hollow Men, in which it seemed every soft shoe shuffle was choreographed to suit the vagaries of the daily media cycle, and every sugar-coated grin, promising much but delivering little, left the Prime Minister of the day looking like a celebrity chef or an impresario from Audible, promoting the acrobats and jugglers and chorus line of cousins waiting in the wings as universally acclaimed working families, whatever that means. Writing about law and politics, I will argue, can move beyond verifiable fact and related analysis on some occasions, especially if the aim is to capture the attention of a younger generation or a popular audience, many of whom may well be indifferent to events that happened long ago, or, to paraphrase Gough Whitlam, insensitive to the virtues of academic studies or skillful journalism. It is apparent from the works of writers in other countries, such as Arthur Kurzweil or Albert Camus or George Orwell, that the novel can be used to discern and convey certain truths about politics of a time and place that stay with the reader due to the singularity of the viewpoint. J.M. Coetzee's novel, Waiting for the Barbarians, in its central metaphor, exposed the folly of the apartheid regime in South Africa by suggesting that the guardians protecting his unnamed empire from external threats were barbarians themselves. His later novel, Disgrace, evokes the mood of apprehension accompanying a transfer of power from a discredited regime to the uncertainties of its successor. Political uncertainty, or an era marked by rapid change, is fertile ground for creative observers, filmmakers, playwrights, or novelists. Confrontation encourages some people to discover different sides to their nature and prompts others to play out their personal dramas on a larger stage. One sees bystanders affected by dilemmas that transcend the personal, but with their own hopes and apprehensions being inevitably brought to the fore. The elements of drama can quickly descend on ordinary people who are affected by the extraordinary nature of their times. In The Great Gatsby, the American novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald not only managed to evoke the characteristics of an era, the jazz age of the 1920s, but in doing so, by drawing upon the past and by the power of his style, he went even further and marked out the continuous and underlying influence of the American dream. Closer to home, we have the example of D.H. Lawrence's novel Kangaroo, in which the author's response to what he experienced was to be mirrored in the future. When Lawrence wrote his novel in 1922, after only a few months in Australia, the right-wing political movement he presented to the reader didn't exist. But what he sensed in the mood of the country became a reality 10 years later with the formation of the New Guard. John Douglas Pringle, a former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, spoke of being overwhelmed by the novel's essential truth. In his book Australian Accent, he went so far as to say, and I quote, "I can think of no more convincing proof of the superiority of the creative writer over the journalist or the historian." Unlike an essay or an article or a polemic or work of non-fiction, a political novel doesn't usually make a specific point. Readers are invited to find meanings for themselves or by exploring the implications of the story. I've developed this line of argument in my recently released book, Legal Limits, which Gerard mentioned in the opening. In various chapters of this book, I look at the relationship between law and literature and the nature of the political novel with particular reference to the Whitlam era. This is because, not so long ago, being intrigued by questions about the significance of the era, by the paucity of creative works bearing upon a crucial moment in Australian history, I settled down to the writing of a novel called Dismissal, which is on the table, but that's it there, the work of fiction which revisits the constitutional crisis of 1975. My novel starts with the Petrov Commission and its consequential effect upon the leadership of the Labour Party, and finishes up with Edward Gough Whitlam standing on the front steps of the National Parliament in Canberra, microphone in hand, urging his supporters to maintain your rage. That day of reckoning marked the end of one controversy, the deferring of supply by Liberal Party senators, but led to another, whether the Governor-General was entitled to or should have acted as he did in deposing a government with a majority in the House of Representatives, contrary to the wishes of the current Prime Minister. Now, both of these controversies aroused fierce passions at the time, and both, of course, have a continuing political relevance to the exercise of power, to the nature of leadership, and to the question of where exactly power resides in Australia at any crucial moment. Even if the Senate's power to block supply is conceded, political parties or individual politicians holding the balance of power in that chamber will think carefully before exercising the power on some future occasion. The scope of the Governor-General's reserve powers remain undefined, but an incumbent's approach to a political stalemate will undoubtedly be affected by the controversy surrounding Remembrance Day 1975. Now, since that time, as I've mentioned earlier, jurists, journalists, historians, leading academics, and the principal protagonists have written about these issues skillfully and at length, but not always for a popular audience. On the other hand, there will be many people in the community, including younger people and the current generation of practicing lawyers, who would appreciate having the story presented to them in an accessible form, or so I submit. They would like to know what it felt like to be there on the day, what it feels like to be dismissed in a political crisis of that kind, and how the legal issues related to the emotions of the day are to be fitted within a portrayal of the entire scene. Novelists are always interested in what people have felt in the course of a drama. They look for a pattern, a way of making sense of upheavals and traumatic happenings, be they domestic or public events. Hence, a novel about the day of reckoning should not be regarded as outlandish or impermissible, especially in a case that brings strong emotions into play a moment in political history, redolent with thwarted ambitions, double dealing, indecision, and betrayal in the manner of a Shakespearean tragedy, hence my reference to Hamlet on the battlements of Elsinore a little earlier. Now, a critical question for novelists is how best to tell a story of this kind. Should one disguise the real events with fictional names or employ Gore Vidal's method of attributing words and deeds to real figures within a framework of what he calls the agreed-upon facts of the era? The 1975 crisis was of such an extraordinary nature that a veil of fiction would have simply added an air of implausibility to the action. That's how I saw it. Better by far to place the real figures in the background, but acting consistently with what they admitted to having said and done, leaving most of the stage to a cast of fictional characters moving about in the foreground. So in the end, I constructed my novel Dismissal as a blend of fact and fiction with a view to exploring some of the silences at the heart of the affair, gaps in the record, various mysteries. Were the Titans at the centre of the stage, Whitman, Fraser, Barwick, Kerr, affected by past ties or by personal flaws or vagaries of character? What motivated Sir John Kerr to move against the Labour leader who had appointed him to high office? Could steps have been taken to resolve the impasse concerning supply by some means other than a sacking and thereby save the current regime, including its imposing principal and all his courtiers? And as to the fictional characters, the brightly costumed players gossiping and conniving in a corner by the footlights, close enough to the audience to be listened to attentively, their bawdy asides, their dark suspicions, was anything said or done by them or by real people like them an influence upon the outcome? Questions of this kind led inexorably to a critical period of 30 minutes or so in King's Hall at lunchtime on the day of reckoning, when things could have gone either way for the opposing party. Did the elements of the drama and the characters of the principal players allow for a different denouement before the curtain fell? Was there a moment of intense ambiguity in King's Hall, fraught with tension, when an alternate history of the affair came close to appearing, the shadow of its offstage presence projected on the parquetry as if in some ominous streetscape conjured up by Giorgio de Chirico? It was in order to dwell upon the possibilities of such a moment that it became necessary for me to flesh out the fictional characters in early chapters of the novel and to establish their supposed links to the real figures and to the crisis that brought them all to Canberra. It was clear also that the story in question would have to be told from the point of view of the losing side. Pull of a story, the awe we feel while in the grip of a compelling tale, as Aristotle noted many centuries ago, are felt most strongly, and a figure we have seen at close quarters, once high and mighty, but now in peril, is overthrown. There must be a change of fortune from good to bad, reversal followed by recognition, and finally catharsis. It was for these reasons, essentially, that in this novel Dismissal, the crucial events are unfolded by Roy Temple QC, a fictional Sydney barrister, who was once on the far left of Australian politics, but in the period leading up to Remembrance Day, has purportedly worked his way into the inner circle of the Whitlam government, a courtier with his own ambitions, one who has much to lose. I laboured to ensure that the subplot concerning Roy Temple's relationship with his friends on the far left of the political scene was gradually unfolded in counterpoint to the main political events. It had to resonate with the central theme of trust and betrayal. The subplot was shaped also to allow for the possibility that the presence of Roy Temple and his friends as advisers might involve the beleaguered government in a fresh controversy if allegations concerning their past ties were revealed. And that, of course, brings me back to another area of difficulty for political novelists working within the framework of actuality, the process of selecting the historical facts and matters to use. In In the end, my novel plays upon and opens up three main areas of ambiguity. First, the findings of the Petrov Commission in the mid-1950s allowed room for speculation that in the Cold War era, government bodies in the United States, Great Britain and Australia had been penetrated by Soviet agents and sympathisers at the highest level, although the extent of the penetration was not fully known, even as late as November 1975. Indeed, it was only a few years later, some of you may recall, a few years after the Whitman dismissals emerged during the Spycatcher trial in Sydney, in which Malcolm Turnbull made his name, that a senior figure in MI5, Sir Roger Hollis, who came to Australia in Kennett's time to help set up the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, or PASIO, was himself under investigation as a possible Soviet spy. Were there people like Kim Philby or possibly Roger Hollis in Australia with an interest in atomic secrets related to the bomb tests on the Montebello Islands and at Maralinga, codenamed Enormaz in the Petrov papers, who were also under suspicion? If so, were such people named in the notorious Document J, which was described by counsel assisting the Petrov Commission as, quote, a farrago of facts, falsity and filth, unquote? The Commission suppressed the document, but it became clear later that it would have been released by Whitlam on or about 11 November 1975, but for the dismissal. Was ASIO or the CIA interested in the pending release of Document J? We find some discussion about Document J in Whitman's Whitman government, which I mentioned some moment ago, and it makes it clear that he was about to release. Let me turn to a second area of ambiguity. The events preceding the fall of the Whitman government included a fateful meeting of the Executive Council in the dining room of the Prime Minister's residence in Canberra, Lodge, on Friday, 13 December 1974, exactly 1 year to the day before the Labour Party was defeated in the double dissolution election following the dismissal. It can be taken as an undisputed or agreed upon fact that late in the evening of that day, after a lengthy period of contentious debate involving Treasury officials and governmental legal advisers, an Executive Council minute was signed by four ministers, Gough Whitlam, Lionel Murphy, Jim Cairns, and the energetic Minister for Minerals and Energy, Rex Connor, popularly known as the Strangler. This controversial minute, signed in the kitchen of the Lodge, on top of the fridge, according to Labour frontbencher Clive Cameron, authorised Connor to borrow for temporary purposes 4,000 million in order to provide immediate protection for Australia in regard to supply of minerals and energy and to deal with current and immediately foreseeable unemployment in Australia. Rex Connor's authority, a green light encouraging him to persist in an ill-fated quest to garner Middle Eastern petrodollars via the mysterious Pakistani money trader Tirith Kemlani, was revoked before any overseas funds were actually obtained. But the revocation, you recall, wasn't enough to neutralise the political controversy arising out of these events, generally known as the loan scandal. Broglio encouraged the Liberals under Fraser to block supply and precipitate the dismissal. As my character Roy Temple puts in the novel, and I quote, "Money that never came, the phantom fund that didn't cost the nation a cent, had now become the worst kind of debt and electoral liability." There is a degree of ambiguity in all of this as to how exactly the Attorney General Lionel Murphy arrived at his courageous opinion, as Sir Humphrey Appleby might have described it, that such a loan could be characterised as being for temporary purposes. Could it be that one of Murphy's sources of advice was a trusted confidant outside the official circle, a barrister from Sydney perhaps, not previously known to the press gallery or to members of the Attorney General's staff, an advisor such as Roy Temple QC? If so, what factors lay behind the advice that was given? Was Temple the source of any other contentious advice in the period leading up to the dismissal or in King's Hall at lunchtime on the day itself? This brings me thirdly and finally to the third area of ambiguity. It appears to be common ground among observers of the scene that in his study at Government House at about 1 p.m. on the day of reckoning, Sir John Kerr handed Prime Minister Whitlam a letter effecting the dismissal. Malcolm Fraser, who was elsewhere on the premises at the time, was sworn in as a so-called caretaker Prime Minister, subject to his undertaking that upon the passing of the supply bills he would advise a double dissolution of both Houses of Parliament and continue to serve as a caretaker until the outcome of the subsequent election was known. It was not known how exactly he would push the supply bills through an evenly divided Senate. In the current era of mobile phones, email, texting and obsessive twitterings, instant communication, news of the dismissal and the circumstances I have just described would undoubtedly have reached every corner of Parliament House within a matter of minutes. But as we are inclined to say of history, the past is another country. All the contemporary accounts suggest that when the Labour leader in the Senate, Ken Reet, and those close to him entered the Senate chamber after lunch to renew their attempt to have the supply bills passed, they were completely unaware that the constitutional deadlock, the crisis that had been running onwards for the past month or so, worsening day by day as money to fund the workings of government ran out, had suddenly been turned upside down. Whitlam was out, Fraser was in, and it now suited the Liberals to have the supply bills passed. This has always been a puzzling feature of the crucial day. What happened in the 30 minutes or so before the Senate resumed its sitting? How did it come about that Ken Reet and his colleagues on the Labour side voted with the Liberals to pass the supply bills, providing Malcolm Fraser with exactly what he wanted? The novel explores this area of ambiguity by tracking the movements of Roy Temp and his friends, and by providing an account of what they said in pursuit of what was said to be a plan to save the Whitlam government, or was it a plan to save themselves? This is not the place to reveal the outcome of whatever plans are afoot that emerges in the novel. Put shortly, a compelling narrative of any kind in court or between the covers of a book is bound to be affected to some extent by the outlook of the audience and by the storyteller's ingenuity in defining the issues. My novel Dismissal was written to explore the possibility of a link between real events and underlying truths and the relationship between law and politics and literature. Readers who seek to be more fully informed about the Whitlam dismissal or wish to be assured of greater accuracy will inevitably move beyond a work of fiction and go to the memoirs of the protagonists, and then the various histories of the affair, or even to legal texts. I invite them to do so. The word novel on the cover of a book containing a work of legal fiction is a warning sign to be careful, but is also at the same time an invitation. That is an encouragement to step through the looking glass in order to look at the world and the circumstances in a new light. The make-believe world behind the looking glass may prove to be of use in determining what we have to forget, what we must remember, and what can only be supplied by our imaginations in order to comprehend what an important moment in Australian political history felt like. So let me sum up just in a line or two, if I may. I've argued in this paper, as was with D.H. Lawrence's novel Kangaroo, that works of fiction written in response to a period of unrest or rapid change can be of use in conveying certain insights or essential truths to a popular audience or to a later generation, including information as linking the mood of one era to what lies ahead. Creative writing of this kind, admittedly, can never be regarded as a substitute for skilled journalism. As to legal or constitutional issues, it of course lacks the objectivity we expect of lawyers and historians. Nonetheless, that much conceded, I submit that plays and novels and film scripts can often add another dimension to the story, and much of that I expand upon in the book of essays, Legal Links, which is there and can be purchased.
Nicholas.
So we come to questions and discussion, and I should say initially many thanks to the Gallipoli Club and Lock the Street here in Sydney for giving us this facility tonight, and you can hang around later on after. So we go to questions and discussion. There are copies of Dismissal and Nicholas Hasluck's most recent book, Legal Limits. Janet Grundy's got it. I'm sure the author will be happy to sign them after. Now, we've got to 7 o'clock, so we've got to move quickly. You've spoken tonight about writing non-fiction history. You've written a dozen books, many novels. You've spoken tonight about the help that Roy Temple QC gave you in working out about the dismissal. Now, tell me, when you're on the Supreme Court of Western Australia, did you ever need the help of Roy Temple over there? I mean, did you need to sort of make some of this stuff up, or is writing judgments so much different from writing history?
Well, I think the short answer to that is that I like to think that I behave conscientiously and judiciously, as one would expect of a judge. And, of course, in other words, I was always attentive to the audience, to the evidence, and any conclusion one came to inevitably was essentially guided by the evidence. And, of course, the submissions of counsel were mostly real counsel, which sometimes exceeded even the most inventive novels and powers that we mentioned, but on the whole, counsel were of great assistance. So the short answer to your question is one does have to, in performing that judicial task, draw a very clear distinction between the world of actuality and the world of fiction.
I've read that Margaret Whitman was appalled when he said that he was accepting the dismissal. Her idea was he should go down to Parliament House and absolutely refuse to be dismissed, if that was possible.
The suggestion is whether Margaret Whitman wanted to commence a revolution in November.
Well, I think I've read that part about probably writings, including that one by Margaret Whitlam. And, of course, there is the other great unknown. I mean, Paul Whitlam, at least I think Paul Keating has been quoted of making some suggestion that perhaps the Governor-General should have been arrested or something of the kind. So, I mean, this is part of the great fascination of that most tumultuous day in Australian politics, that all sorts of other things could have happened. Of course, Margaret Whitlam did say that, but I think one has to remember that Gough Whitlam was himself the son of a former Commonwealth Solicitor General, Craig Whitlam, and I would think it would be deeply instilled in his psychological makeup that parliamentary procedures and conventions can't be lightly set aside, so it would have been a moment of really crossing a line into a completely unknown universe. If Whitlam had simply refused to accept the letter or torn up the letter or something else had happened, I think Whitlam himself is on the record of saying that had he known Malcolm Fraser was on the premises, he would not have set foot in Government House, because he could only conclude by Fraser's presence that something striking and untoward as he saw it was about to happen. Now, that would have been a more subtle and a more finessed situation, because that would have left the dilemma as to how exactly the Governor-General would have affected the purpose, the decision that had clearly come to in his own mind to be done. So, I mean, this is why I was perhaps drawn to writing a novel about the matter, to speculate upon some of the what-ifs in the whole situation, and there are many, and perhaps other filmmakers or scriptwriters or novelists will come back to me.
Does Roy Temple drink much, does
he? I don't think I discussed at length, but if he's a senior barrister from the Sydney Bar, he probably does.
Stuart, yeah.
Mr. Hasluck, I read your novel, and Dismissal, and I enjoyed it very much. And I just wanted, on your third theme in your talk, you say that the lunchtime in King's Hall, that it could have gone either way. I put to you that in actual fact it could only go one way, because in the Senate, in a chamber of 60 senators, that the line-up was that the Coalition had 30 seats, the ALP 28, the independent Bunton was supporting the ALP for passage of the supply, and Field was not allowed to vote because he was before the High Court, his appointment was before the High Court. So it was 30 versus 29. Who was going to cross from the Coalition to the ALP side to stop the supply going through? So I put to you that, what I'm saying is that, do you really believe that's a political reality, or was it a mechanism just for your novel that you're using there?
Well, I might call on a very knowledgeable member of the audience in a moment to add to what I say, but I'm principally going upon an analysis of the situation made by the former clerk of the Senate, Hodges. And as he canvasses the sort of things that might have been done on that view of the matter, Whitlam, in addition to passing a vote of their confidence in the lower house, should also have passed a motion seeking to retrieve the bills from the upper house, or at least had Reid and his colleagues in the Senate pass delaying a motion so that the entirety of that afternoon there would not have been a resolution, even though, what I see Forstum up to say, even though in following days the outcome might have been as you've described. But if the ambush, if you can call it that, had not succeeded immediately, and there had been 48 hours of protracted controversy in the press, with some signs of some Liberal senators, such as Alan Wilson and others, wavering a little as to where they would go if matters push came to shove, I think, I suppose that's what I'm really playing. There is force in what you say, but I think there is room for debate as to what parliamentary tactics might have been employed to spin out the matter and thus, in effect, throw the political situation across to the press and the wider public and so on. Now, I see John Paul's... I might want to add something there.
Mike, John, don't, because you stand in front of the camera, so...
Would I come up
there? Yeah, you come up here briefly. Yeah.
Of course.
You mean you were relying on the press to sort out the situation?
Not to sort it out.
Yes. I think you're right about Rob Whitlam's sense of propriety in the matter. His father, by the way, was the Commonwealth Crown Solicitor, not the Solicitor General. The two offices are frequently confused. But anyway, as for Fraser's presence, that was largely due to a misunderstanding anyway, that he arrived at Government House as early as he did. I think it's actually, what's the old expression, post hoc ergo propter hoc, when Whitlam says, oh, had I known that he was going to Government House, I would never have set foot in the place. On the Senate, Gough Whitlam himself has argued against the proposition that there was any likelihood that Fraser could not get the appropriation bills through the Senate, and he's argued this most strongly, pointing out that two independents, Cleaver Bunton and Raymond Steele Hall, would have voted with the Liberal Party, the coalition parties, to put the bills through. His whole strategy was to get his position confirmed by the House of Representatives. And he could say, there is no longer a crisis. Supply has been passed. Now the Governor General is under an obligation to recommission me. Well, of course, it just didn't work out that way. So I'm very sceptical about this notion that there could have been a reversal in the Senate on that day. And I have the authority of Gough Whitlam for saying so.
Thank you, John. There has been a request to get Roy Temple QC down here. Apparently he's drunk in the gutter outside. Now, who's next? Who's down the back, yeah. John.
Do you think it was not fair comment to suggest that the fact that the Whitlam dismissal, the embargo surrounding it, still reverberates so heavily in Australian politics, political history, that in fact that reflects the extraordinary mediocrity and unusual but pleasant tranquility of our political structure? Because if you compare it, I find it difficult to think of any other country with exception to New Zealand, perhaps Canada, in which this particular event would be sort of the great event of political history. It just seems to me, basically, in 20 years' time, it would be considered relatively absurd. And I include Canada, but on reflection, I take that out because events in Quebec always provide much more interest.
Well, I think what I can say in brief is that I see force in what you say. I suppose it's just the unusual nature of that the political event, which in the Australian context gives it a resonance which continues. But you're perfectly right, in a whole lot of European countries, and especially more so in a whole lot of South American countries, I mean, this would be scarcely noticed.
I'm just aware of H.B. Evatt's book, The King and His Dominion Governors, which was published about 8 years before the dismissal of the Independence of 56. Goes into considerable detail about powers of the Crown through governors or governors general have been used across the decades in different places. Talks about the Jack Lang dismissal here in New South Wales and so on. And one wonders if, had bought that book and read it, he might have been more cautious of the powers of the Governor General. Powers of the monarchical system.
Well, I'm sure he would have been aware of it, and of course John Kerr in his autobiographical work Matters of Judgment asserts that he had a close understanding of that from an early stage. I think Whitlam's stance throughout would be that he just assumed the fundamental precept that the Governor-General would act upon the advice of his Prime Minister really displaced the apprehension that the reserve power would be utilised. But I must say, when I was researching this book, and I spoke to a lot of people, both in journalism and politics and so forth, it did surprise me how much in the press gallery, the members of the press gallery seemed to be absolutely dumbfounded when the event happened. Although, of course, Ellicott had sort of put out the opinion, he had foreshadowed exactly what he thought the power and the duty of the Governor General was. The Liberals, in effect, were pushing for this to be exercised. But it just almost seemed as even the most astute observers in the press gallery simply blithely overlooked the possibility that things might play out in that way, probably because they hadn't read the Evatt book and the presence of a reserve power was thought to be just a rather arcane and legalistic sort of one.
Nicholas, in fact, I know it seems like a storm in a teacup, but in a sense it was a real test of our constitutional system. And with docudramas and drama and West Wing and all that stuff, there's a tendency to feel the government is just that, a few personalities, they get into Parliament, they run the country. But to what extent did November 1975 really test, you're a jurist, test our constitutional strength of the system? And to what extent do we need a better understanding of, on one hand, how fragile it might be, but also, in a sense, how knowledgeable it really is? I mean, it is a system that as yet has not broken down. So there must be, you know, there must be a full force to it, and that we need to really recognise that we have got something that needs a great deal of understanding and a great deal of wise people running it.
Well, I think this is part of the continuing enigma of the dismissal, because the matter can be argued either way. There would be many people who would say, well, the whole event just revealed the great strength and durability of the Australian Constitution, because the reserve power added a degree of or an avenue of finesse, as it were, to resolve an impasse and so on. But on the other hand, the whole broad issue, which is an unresolved issue for constitutional lawyers, is that, of course, as we know, our Constitution came forward as a blend of the Westminster system of responsible government and the American precedent in so many ways. So the contest, it's really still an unresolved issue as to in what circumstances the Senate, the so-called States House, being drawn from the American precedent, should be permitted to exercise a power of the kind that the Liberals exercised back then, because it might be argued that
they perhaps legalistically had the power to block the supply, but was the Constitution ever really intended to work like that when pursuant to the Westminster system, the power is thought to reside in the lower house of the discussion? I can quickly give a contest on this.
You have me brief, Kevin, yeah?
You are aware, of course, that the precedent of the Senate being able to undo things the government had done was started by the leader of the opposition, the then Lionel Murphy, in the Senate, and that was something that boomeranged on them very badly.
Yes, indeed. Yes, that's absolutely correct.
No, we're getting good. A couple, yeah, Wayne, and then here, and then one more. Yeah, Wayne.
Right. I'll ask that. You mentioned that Whitlam saw this as a progress towards the republic. The same situation could have occurred under a republic of Senate block and supply.
Yeah.
The head of state could have been president. Whitlam could then not have called the Queen to remove the Governor General. Presumably there'd be an impeachment process. But would the Republic been even more dramatic in terms of these circumstances for another?
Suggesting that the same thing could have occurred under a Republic.
Well, of course, it depends on what sort of republic is put in place. I mean, at the moment, the proposal, by and large, debate about the republic has tended to focus upon a minimalist model where effectively a president would be very much like the Governor-General in terms of his powers and his position. But if you went for an elected president, then there might be a different kind of ethos altogether. But presuming the former model, yes, I think it's the same sort of thing could occur.
Get
in
back, and then we're over here. Yeah.
Yes, I understand that this is not directly within the subject matter of the discussion this evening. But do you have a view, sir, and if so, you can tell us what it is, concerning the role of Sir Garfield Barwick and Sir Anthony Mason in this whole...
Okay, do you have a view about the role of Sir Garfield Barwick and Sir Anthony Mason as High Court judges?
Well, again, this is one of the continuing areas of debate. I think this is perhaps one area in which the debate has moved on, because I very much doubt whether any High Court judge in the present era, and against the background of these events, would be minded to advise either formally, as Barwick did in providing some written advice, or informally, as we are led to believe Sir Anthony Mason may have done it. I think High Court judges now would see that there is a far higher level of critique for some interaction between the executive and the judiciary in the present atmosphere. That would be my own take on it. So I suppose that's the short answer is that I think in the fullness of time, I would venture was probably unwise and perhaps a little injudicious to become involved in ways that
not Jeffrey.
You said that the press gallery was taken by surprise. What's your view of the role of the media after the event? And second question, if I may, were you aware that there was a second coup that day? That in the ABC, the Current Affairs Department seized both circuit landlines from Sydney to Canberra and prevented the news division from reporting the events?
Well, I have to say I'm simply not aware of that. That's another fascinating, perhaps it's another novel in or a sequel in that, but no, I wasn't aware of that quite seriously, and that I think is a matter of real interest and concern. I don't think I can really add very much to what you have said.
Finally, you spoke briefly about your father, Sir Paul Hasluck, and you've edited a very fine collection of his work talking about his colleagues. Although some of his colleagues, if they're still alive, may not think of that way. It's quite devastating at times. But did he ever talk to you about the 11th of November or any kind of discussions there? Because he could, I mean, it was possible that he might have been Governor-General in November 1975. That was always a possibility. Did he ever talk about these matters?
Well, I talk very widely with my father about a whole range of matters, but I would have to say he kept his own counsel on that
very specific subject as to how he might have acted, or I think you yourself have interviewed him and others have done. And as a matter of fact, I think rather than be trying to extrapolate, I just might mention that I think it was a piece published in the Sydney Morning Herald some time ago. I've just taken this off the internet, in which comments are attributed to my father, and I think the gist of that is to say that he thought it was that he would not have, he was surprised that Whitlam was prepared to let the Governor-General talk to Malcolm Fraser in the weeks and days leading up to the dismissal, because he would not have been inclined to do that, seeing the Prime Minister as his sole advisor, or and therefore almost by implication sole source of information. He did not think it was appropriate that the Governor-General was talking to the leader of the opposition. The line of communication should simply be with the Prime Minister. So I think the thrust of what is attributed to my father here really is that he would have had a greater sense of involvement with the Prime Minister and would have expected to give that would have led to a greater sense of trust and a warning if there was likely to be some precipitation.
Many thanks, Nicholas. Thank you. Look, we could go on all night, but it's right on 7 o'clock when you stop. So thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility. Nicholas spoke Legal Limits, which is a collection of essays, part memoir, part essays, including one chapter on the dismissal and other material. This is available tonight, as is Nicholas's novel Dismissal. But for tonight, many thanks for stimulating the press and for getting us thinking on what was really one of the really big events of Australia in the 20th century, and we're great to have your views on it tonight, and as expressed in your books and as told to us here tonight. So well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.